A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
100,000 people standing in total silence at the Western Wall Plaza. Hundreds of men in white prayer shawls covering their faces. Hands raised with fingers spread in that strange Spock-like formation, chanting three lines in unison. And the silence between the lines is so complete, you can hear the wind off the Judean hills. It happens exactly twice a year, Pesach and Sukkot. And it feels less like a synagogue service and more like someone opened a portal to the Second Temple. Which raises the question Daniel sent us. Where did this practice actually come from? And how did a three-verse biblical command turn into a mass spectacle that draws over 100,000 people?
The thing is, those three verses are the oldest biblical text we have physical evidence for outside the Bible itself. We're going to get to that because it's genuinely astonishing. But to answer the prompt directly, the practice originates in Numbers chapter 6, verses 22 through 27. God tells Moses to tell Aaron and his sons, the priests, that when they bless the Israelites, they must use these exact words. Not their own words, not a spontaneous prayer, a verbatim script.
Which already tells you something. This isn't a priest composing a blessing. This is a priest as a human loudspeaker.
The Hebrew is Ko Tavarku, thus shall you bless. It's a divine speech act being channeled through human mouths, and the text itself is structured in a way that rewards close reading, three verses, each one longer than the last. The first is three Hebrew words, the second is five, the third is seven. 15 words total. It expands like a ripple.
3, 5, 7. That's not accidental.
Nothing in this text is accidental. The first verse, Yevarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, may God bless you and keep you. Three words, the simplest. The second, Yader Adonai panav elecha bichuneka, may God shine his face upon you and be gracious to you. Five words introduces the metaphor of the divine face, which is intimate and almost unsettling. The third, Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem loka shalom, may God lift his face to you and grant you peace. Seven words, the longest, and it lands on shalom, which in biblical Hebrew doesn't just mean absence of conflict. It means wholeness, completion, everything in its right place.
The structure itself is doing theological work. You start with protection, move to grace, end with cosmic wholeness. And each step takes more words to articulate.
Each step increases the intimacy. The divine face, which in the second verse is shining, that's distant, like the sun, in the third verse is lifted toward you. It's direct eye contact. For an ancient Near Eastern context, that's radical. You don't look at the king's face without permission. You certainly don't look at God's face. And here, God is lifting his face to you.
Let's talk about the archaeological elephant in the room, because this is where it gets wild. The Ketef Hinnom amulets.
This is one of those discoveries that rewrites what scholars thought they knew. In 1979, archaeologists were excavating a burial cave on a ridge overlooking the Hinnom Valley, just south of Jerusalem's Old City. They found two tiny silver scrolls, about the size of a cigarette butt each, rolled up and originally worn as amulets on a cord around the neck. When they finally managed to unroll them, and this took years because silver that's been in a tomb for 2.5 millennia doesn't unroll easily, they found the priestly blessing inscribed on them.
These date to roughly 600 BCE. That's the First Temple period. That's before the Babylonian exile.
Which makes this the oldest surviving biblical text anywhere outside the Bible itself. We're talking 400 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they weren't found in a synagogue or a library. They were found in a tomb, worn as protective amulets.
From the earliest period we have evidence for, people were using this text apotropaically as magical protection. Wear the blessing, and the blessing protects you.
Which complicates the clean categories we like to impose. Is the priestly blessing a prayer? A magical incantation? The Ketef Hinnom amulets suggest that ancient Israelites didn't draw those lines the way we do. The same words pronounced by priests in the temple were also worn around people's necks to ward off evil. The text had power in multiple modes.
The blessing is wearable technology.
The amulets contain a slightly different version of the text than what we have in the Masoretic Bible, which tells us the wording wasn't entirely fixed even in the 6th century BCE. But the core is unmistakably the same blessing.
We've got the biblical origin. Number 6, Divine Speech Act, 3 expanding verses. We've got the archaeological evidence pushing it back to at least 600 BCE and showing it functioning as a protective amulet. Now let's talk about how it was actually performed in the temple, because the Mishnah gives us an almost cinematic description.
Tractate, Tamid, Chapter 7, Mishnah 2. The daily routine in the temple was this. After the morning sacrifice, the priest would ascend the platform called the Dukan. That's where we get the Yiddish word dutchening, going up to the Dutchen to bless. They would remove their shoes, because you stand barefoot on holy ground. They would raise their hands to shoulder height.
The hand position. This is the detail everyone knows without knowing they know it.
The fingers spread in a specific formation. The two hands together create 5 gaps between the fingers, thumbs from index, index from middle, middle from ring, ring from pinky. 5 gaps, corresponding to 5 divine attributes in Kabbalistic thought, though that interpretation came later. The practical reason is simpler. You're making a lattice through which the divine presence, the Shekinah, can shine through.
The hands aren't just raised. They're configured as a kind of spiritual aperture.
The priests would cover their faces and hands with their prayer shawls. The tallit, because the Shekinah was believed to rest on their fingers during the blessing, and you don't gaze directly at the divine presence. This is the same reason the congregation traditionally avoids looking at the priest during the blessing. In many communities, people cover their own faces with their tallit or look down.
Which creates this strange dynamic where everyone is deliberately not looking at the one thing everyone is there for.
It's the liturgical equivalent of not looking directly at the sun during an eclipse. You know something powerful is happening, but you shield yourself from it. Now, in the temple, there was one more element that made this radically different from anything we experience today. The priest pronounced the Tetragrammaton, the 4-letter divine name, YHVH, as it was written.
Which is something that stopped completely after 70 CE.
The Mishnah is explicit about this. In the temple, the divine name was pronounced as written. In the rest of the country, they used a substitute name, Adonai. And after the temple was destroyed, the pronunciation of the Tetragrammaton was lost entirely. We don't know how it was said. Every attempt to reconstruct it is speculative.
The daily temple ritual involved barefoot priests on a platform, hands raised in a specific lattice formation, chanting a 15-word blessing while pronouncing the unpronounceable name of God, and the congregation responding, Amen. After each verse. This happened every single day.
Every day after the morning sacrifice. And then in 70 CE, the temple burns, the priesthood loses its institutional function, and everything has to be reimagined.
Which brings us to the most interesting part of the story.
The rabbis of the Mishnah and Talmud faced an existential question. Without the temple, what do you do with a ritual that was designed for a temple context? You can't just stop doing it, it's a biblical commandment. But you can't do it the same way either, because the entire infrastructure is gone.
They had to invent a version of the blessing that could survive without the thing it was built for.
The Talmudic discussions in Sotah, 38a through 39a, are fascinating because you can see them working this out in real time. Who can perform the blessing? Only a Kohen, a descendant of Aaron, that much is clear from the biblical text. But what if the Kohen has a speech impediment? What if he's missing fingers so he can't form the hand position? What if he's killed someone, even accidentally? Does that disqualify him? The Talmud goes through case after case.
They're building a legal framework around a ritual that had previously been defined by its physical context. When you have the temple, you don't need to ask these questions. The priests just do what they've always done. Once the temple is gone, every detail becomes a halakhic problem to solve.
Here's where the geography of Judaism starts to diverge in ways that persist to this day. In the land of Israel, the priestly blessing was performed daily in synagogues, just as it had been in the temple. But in the diaspora, Babylon, and later Europe, it was restricted to festivals only. The Talmud in Megillah 32b gives a wonderfully specific reason. The blessing requires the Kohanim to be in a state of joy, and the sages were concerned that on ordinary weekdays in the diaspora, the Kohanim might have drunk wine with their meals and wouldn't be in the proper state. On festivals, everyone is joyful by definition. It's a commanded joy, so the concern doesn't apply.
The diaspora gets the blessing only on Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Meanwhile, in Israel, it's every morning.
In Jerusalem, it's every morning at the Western Wall. But even within Israel, the practice varies. In most Israeli synagogues, the blessing is performed every day during the morning service. But the mass public ceremony at the Western Wall, which is what Daniel's prompt is really about, that's something else entirely.
Twice a year, hundreds of Kohanim, over 100,000 people. It's the blessing turned into a pilgrimage event, and it's not ancient.
It started in 1970. Rabbi Shlomo Goren, who was a fascinating and controversial figure, he was the first chief rabbi of the IDF and later Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel. He revived the full temple-style blessing at the Western Wall during the intermediate days of Sukkot. And he made a specific, provocative choice. He had the Kohanim pronounce the divine name as Adonai, rather than the euphemism Hashem, that had become standard in most Jewish liturgy.
Wait, that's considered provocative?
In many Orthodox communities, even Adonai is considered too close to the actual divine name for casual use outside of formal prayer. People say Hashim, literally the name, as a substitute for the substitute. So when Goren insisted on Adonai for the mass blessing, he was making a statement. This isn't a synagogue service. This is a temple ritual, reconstructed.
1970. This is 3 years after the Six-Day War, when Israel regained control of the Western Wall for the first time since 1948. The wall was suddenly accessible to Jews again, and Goren is essentially saying, now that we have the wall back, let's bring back what the wall was built for.
The timing matters. Goren had been the IDF chief rabbi who accompanied the paratroopers into the Old City in 1967. There's a famous photograph of him blowing the shofar at the wall right after it was captured. For him, the mass priestly blessing was the next logical step. The shofar announces the return. The blessing enacts it.
Let's talk about the logistics of what this looks like now, because the scale is staggering.
300 to 500 Kohanim gather on a raised platform at the back of the Western Wall Plaza. They're all covered in white prayer shawls, the tallit pulled completely over their heads and faces. A cantor leads the congregation through a series of responsive prayers, calling out each word of the blessing one at a time, and the Kohanim repeat after him in unison. The cantor says, Yivareka. The Kohanim chant, Yivareka. The cantor says, Adonai. The Kohanim chant, Adonai. And so on through all 15 words.
Word by word, that's not how it works in a normal synagogue.
In a normal synagogue, the cantor recites the blessing word by word and the Kohanim repeat, but the pacing is different. It's integrated into the flow of the repetition of the Amidah prayer. At the mass blessing, the cantor essentially stops everything and leads the Kohanim through the blessing as a standalone ritual. The call and response is drawn out, deliberate, almost operatic, and the crowd of 100,000 plus stands in absolute silence, no children crying. It's unnerving if you've never experienced it.
I've been there. The silence is the most striking part. You're standing in a plaza that's normally chaotic. Tourists, beggars, soldiers, tour guides shouting in six languages. And during those three verses, everything stops. The only sound is the amplified voice of the cantor and the massed response of hundreds of Kohanim. It's like the city itself holds its breath.
The visual is just as powerful. All those white shrouded figures on the platform, hands extended under the talitot, fingers spread. From the plaza, you can't see their faces, just these anonymous, identical figures, which is the point. The Kohen in this moment isn't an individual, he's a channel. The personality disappears.
The blessing as an impersonal transmission system, which takes us back to numbers. Thus shall you bless, not compose something nice, not speak from the heart.
Now, there's a controversy here that gets at something deep about contemporary Judaism. Not everyone thinks the mass blessing is a good idea.
The spectacle critique.
Some Orthodox authorities argue that turning the priestly blessing into a mass public event with loudspeakers and tourist buses violates the sanctity of the ritual. The blessing, in their view, is supposed to be an intimate act within the congregation, not a photo opportunity. They worry it becomes a performance rather than a genuine religious act.
Which is an ancient anxiety. The Mishnah itself warns against turning prayer into a fixed routine, keva, as opposed to kavanah, intention. So the critique has deep roots, but the counterargument is equally interesting.
The counter-argument is that the mass blessing reclaims something that was lost. In the temple, the priestly blessing was a public event. It happened daily in front of the entire assembled people. The synagogue version, tucked into the repetition of the Amidah with a handful of Kohanim at the front of the room, is actually the diminished form. The mass blessing at the wall, in this view, is the restoration.
Both sides can claim they're the authentic tradition. One side says the synagogue practice preserved the blessing's sanctity through 2,000 years of exile, and the spectacle cheapens it. The other side says the synagogue practice is itself a compromise with exile, and the spectacle is what the blessing was always meant to be.
This debate is really about something bigger. It's about whether Judaism should actively reconstruct temple practices or whether it should remember them from a distance. The rabbis after 70 CE made a deliberate choice to replace sacrifice with prayer, the temple with the synagogue, the priesthood with the community of scholars. The mass blessing pushes against that choice. It says, maybe we don't have to accept the rabbinic compromise forever.
Which is a deeply uncomfortable question for a lot of Jews, because the rabbinic compromise is what Judaism has been for most of the last 2,000 years.
Here's where the Samaritan comparison becomes illuminating. The Samaritans, who split from the Judeans roughly 2,500 years ago, never experienced the rabbinic transformation. They never lost their priesthood. They never stopped performing sacrifices on Mount Gerizim. And they never stopped performing the priestly blessing daily, in what they believe is the original form, with the original pronunciation of the divine name.
The Samaritans are a living control group. They show us what the blessing might look like if Judaism had never gone through the trauma of 70 CE and the rabbinic reinvention that followed.
Their version is different. The text is slightly different. Samaritan Hebrew isn't identical to Jewish Hebrew. The hand position is different, and they pronounce the divine name, which in their tradition has been preserved continuously. Whether their pronunciation is actually the original one is impossible to verify, but the fact that they have a continuous tradition of pronouncing it at all is remarkable.
It's like a linguistic fossil, a practice that died out in Judaism, but survived in a parallel branch of the Israelite family.
Which raises the question, what counts as authentic? Is the Samaritan practice more authentic because it's older and uninterrupted? Or is the Jewish practice more authentic because it's the one that evolved through the rabbinic tradition that most Jews consider authoritative? The question doesn't have a clean answer, and that's exactly the point.
The search for the original priestly blessing is a trap. There's no single original. There's the biblical text, which was already being worn as amulets in the 6th century BCE in a slightly different form from what we have now. There's the temple practice, which we know from the Mishnah, but can't fully reconstruct. There's the synagogue practice, which diverged between Israel and the diaspora. And there's the mass blessing, which is a 1970 revival that claims to restore the temple practice, but is obviously a modern creation.
Yet all of them use the same 15 words. That's what's extraordinary. The container changes. Amulet, temple platform, synagogue ark, Western Wall Plaza, Mount Gerizim. But the words are identical or nearly identical across 2,600 years. The Ketef Hinnom amulet from 600 BCE and the mass blessing at the wall in 2026 recite the same text.
There's something almost defiant about that. Empires rise and fall, the temple is destroyed twice, the people are exiled and scattered, and the words don't change.
Which brings us to what this tells us about ritual design, because there's a practical lesson here for anyone interested in how rituals work and why some survive.
Fixed text, physical choreography, community participation.
The fixed text is the anchor. No improvisation allowed. The Kohanim don't get to ad-lib. They don't get to update the language for modern sensibilities. The words are the words, and their antiquity is part of their power. When you hear Yevarecha Adonai V'Ishmerecha, you're hearing exactly what your ancestors heard. That continuity is the whole point.
The physical choreography is the second element. Your body is doing something unusual, which signals to your brain that something unusual is happening. This isn't just thinking. This is doing.
The hand position in particular is a brilliant piece of ritual design because it's distinctive enough to be memorable but simple enough to be teachable. Any Kohen can learn it. It doesn't require special equipment or training. And it creates a visual that's instantly recognizable across any language or culture.
The Vulcans salute before there were Vulcans.
Leonard Nimoy was Jewish. He grew up seeing the priestly blessing in synagogue. He adapted the hand position for Spock. So yes, literally, the Vulcan salute is the priestly blessing. Nimoy talked about it in interviews. He peeked when he wasn't supposed to, saw the Kohanim's hands under their talatot, and years later thought, this is what an alien greeting should look like.
The priestly blessing made it into Star Trek. The reach of this ritual is absurd.
The third element is community participation. The congregation doesn't just watch, they respond, Amen, after each verse. In some traditions, there are additional responsive prayers before and after. At the Mass blessing, the cantor leads a long series of psalms and supplications, and the crowd responds as one. You're not an audience member, you're a participant. The ritual doesn't work without you.
This is where the Mass blessing achieves something a normal synagogue service can't. When 100,000 people say Amen in unison, you feel it physically. The sound hits you in the chest. It's the difference between listening to a recording and being at a live concert.
The ritual designer in me is taking notes. Fixed text for continuity. Physical choreography for embodiment. Community response for collective effervescence. That's Durkheim's term, the electric feeling of a group experiencing something sacred together. The priestly blessing has all three, and that's why it survived when so many other temple rituals disappeared entirely.
Let's talk about what disappeared. Because the priestly blessing is the survivor, but it wasn't the only priestly ritual. The sacrifices are gone. The incense offering is gone. The Yom Kippur scapegoat ritual is gone. The water libation on Sukkot is gone, mostly, though there's been a revival of that too in some circles.
The priestly blessing survived precisely because it didn't require the temple. The text is portable. The choreography is portable. The only thing you need is a Kohen, and there are Kohanim everywhere. You don't need an altar or a high priest or a red heifer. You just need a descendant of Aaron who knows the hand position and can recite 15 words.
It's the most exportable piece of the temple apparatus. Everything else was infrastructure dependent. The blessing just needed mouths and hands.
Yet even this most portable of rituals has a center of gravity. The Mass blessing at the Western Wall has become the iconic version, the one that shows up in tourist brochures and Instagram posts. And that creates an interesting dynamic where the twice-yearly spectacle overshadows the daily synagogue practice.
Which is another version of the authenticity question. Is the real priestly blessing, the one that happens every morning in a Jerusalem synagogue with 3 Kohanim and 20 worshippers, or the one that happens twice a year with 500 Kohanim and 100,000 people?
The answer depends on what you think the blessing is for. If it's a commandment to be fulfilled, the daily synagogue version is the real one. It's the actual mitzvah. If it's an experience to be had, the Mass version wins. And modern Judaism is increasingly experience-driven.
That's the tension in a nutshell. Obligation versus experience. The daily grind of commandment versus the biannual peak moment. And the Mass blessing is successful precisely because it makes the ritual rare enough to be special.
Scarcity creates value. When the priestly blessing happened every day in the temple, it was routine. The Mishnah describes it as part of the daily schedule, right after the morning sacrifice, no more remarkable than the incense offering or the clearing of the altar. When it moved to the synagogue, it was still daily in Israel, but less visible. A brief moment in a long service. When it became twice yearly as a Mass event, it became something people travel for.
The ritual got rarer and more powerful at the same time. It's the opposite of inflation.
There's a question lurking here that I don't think has a settled answer. As the Mass blessing grows, and it has grown from a few thousand participants in 1970 to over 100,000 now, does it pull people away from the daily synagogue practice, or does it serve as an entry point that brings them back to daily practice?
The festival. Only Jew is a well-known phenomenon in Israel. People who don't go to synagogue on a regular Saturday but show up for Yom Kippur and the Mass priestly blessing. Is that a failure of daily practice or a success of the peak experience?
The data would suggest it's both. The Mass blessing reaches people who would never encounter the ritual otherwise. But it also reinforces the idea that the ritual is something you go to rather than something you do. It becomes a destination rather than a discipline.
Which is the broader story of modern spirituality in about 6 different traditions. The pilgrimage replaces the practice. The peak experience replaces the daily discipline. And the priestly blessing is a perfect case study, because you can see the whole arc, from daily temple ritual to daily synagogue obligation to biennial mass spectacle, compressed into a single practice.
Yet the words remain. That's the thing I keep coming back to. Whatever else changes, the 15 words don't change. The Kohanim at the Western Wall in 2026 are saying exactly what the Kohanim on the Temple Mount said in the 1st century, what the amulet wearers in Ketev Hinnom wore around their necks in the 6th century BCE. The infrastructure collapses, the priesthood loses its function, the people are scattered across continents, and the words just keep going.
Which is either a miracle or a monument to human stubbornness.
I think the Ketev Hinnom amulets are the key to understanding this, because those amulets tell us that from the very beginning, people understood this text as having power independent of its official liturgical context. You didn't have to be in the temple to receive the blessing. You could wear it. You could carry it with you. The text was always portable.
The portability isn't a post-temple adaptation. It's baked into the thing from the start. The blessing was never exclusively a temple ritual, even when the temple stood. It was already escaping into the wild, being worn as jewelry, being inscribed on doorposts, being recited in contexts we can't reconstruct.
That might be the real answer to Daniel's question about where the practice originated. The biblical text gives us the official origin, number 6, God to Moses to Aaron. But the archaeological evidence suggests that the blessing's life on the ground was always bigger and messier than the official version. People took these words and used them, passed them on. The practice didn't originate in a single moment. It emerged from a community that found these words compelling enough to keep using them for 2,500 years.
That's a satisfying answer, but I want to push on one thing. You said the words don't change, but they do, slightly. The Ketev Hinnom version isn't word for word identical to the Masoretic text. The Samaritan version is different. Even within Judaism, the Yemenite tradition preserves a different vocalization of some words than the Ashkenazi tradition.
The core is stable. The three-verse structure, the divine name, the key verbs, bless, keep, shine, be gracious, lift, grant peace. But the exact wording has minor variations. And that's actually more interesting than perfect uniformity would be. It means the text is stable enough to be recognizable across millennia, but flexible enough to survive in different communities.
Recognizable but not frozen. Alive but not improvised. There's a sweet spot there for ritual texts, and the priestly blessing hits it.
The variations tell their own story. The Ketev Hinnom amulets include some additional phrases that aren't in the biblical version, blessings for deliverance from evil and for the restoration of the spirit. The amulet wearer wanted more than the standard 15 words. They wanted customized protection, which tells you that even in the first temple period, people were personalizing the ritual.
The tension between official liturgy and popular practice is probably as old as liturgy itself.
Let's talk about the hand position one more time, because there's a detail I find fascinating. The Talmud discusses what happens if a Kohen has a hand deformity that prevents the standard finger formation. The answer is that he shouldn't perform the blessing, because the hand position is essential. But the Talmud also says that the congregation shouldn't look at the Kohanim's hands during the blessing anyway, to avoid distraction.
The hand position is so important that a Kohen without it can't perform the blessing, but nobody's supposed to be looking at it.
It's a ritual requirement that is simultaneously mandatory and invisible. The Kohen must do it correctly, but the congregation is forbidden from checking whether he is. It's a perfect illustration of how ritual logic doesn't operate by ordinary practical reasoning.
The Kohen's hands are like the emperor's new clothes, except the clothes are real, and everyone is deliberately not looking at them.
This connects to the talit covering. The Kohanim cover their faces and hands with the talit during the blessing, partly so they're not distracted, partly so the congregation isn't distracted, but also because the Shekinah is believed to rest on their fingers, and you shield yourself from direct exposure to the divine presence. The covering isn't about hiding. It's about containing.
Containing the sacred. Like shielding a radioactive source.
That's actually not a bad analogy. The priestly blessing in this framework is a controlled release of divine energy, mediated through the Kohen's hands, contained by the talit, and received by the congregation through the Amen responses. Every element of the choreography serves to manage the flow of sacred power.
The mass blessing at the walls scales this up to industrial proportions. 500 kohanim instead of 3, 100,000 recipients instead of a synagogue full, loudspeakers broadcasting the words across the plaza. The sacred power is being amplified and distributed on a massive scale.
Which is exactly what makes some traditionalists uncomfortable. The intimate, contained ritual becomes a public broadcast. The controlled release becomes a spectacle. The question is whether the spectacle enhances or diminishes the sacred power. And I don't think there's an objective answer to that. It depends on what you think sacred power is and how it works.
If you think sacred power is like a liquid, dilute it and it gets weaker. The mass blessing is a problem. If you think it's like a flame, light more candles from it and it doesn't diminish. The mass blessing is fine.
That's a very corn way of putting it, and I think it's exactly right. The metaphor you choose determines the conclusion you reach.
Where does this leave us? We've traced the priestly blessing from number 6 to the Ketef Hinnom amulets, to the temple platform, to the diaspora synagogue, to the Western Wall Plaza. We've seen it function as a divine speech act, a protective amulet, a daily obligation, a festival ritual, and a mass pilgrimage event. The words are stable. The choreography is stable, but the meaning keeps shifting.
The meaning will keep shifting. In 20 years, will the mass blessing have expanded to other locations? Will virtual reality allow people to participate remotely? Will the Samaritan's continuous tradition attract more attention from Jews interested in recovering lost practices? The ritual isn't finished. It's still evolving.
The one thing I'd bet on. 15 words, 3 verses, hands raised, fingers spread. Whatever else changes, that core will still be there.
Because it survived everything else. Babylonians, Romans, Crusaders, the destruction of 2 temples, 2,000 years of exile, the Holocaust, the secularization of modern society. If anything was going to kill the priestly blessing, it would have done so by now.
The blessing is the cockroach of Jewish ritual.
I was going to say the blessing is the blessing of Jewish ritual, but sure, cockroach works too.
You're welcome. So, to circle back to what Daniel was asking, the practice originated in Numbers 6 as a divine command to Aaron and his sons, but it was already functioning as a popular protective text by 600 BCE. The temple version was a daily choreographed ritual with the full divine name. After 70 CE, the rabbis reinvented it for the synagogue, creating the split between daily practice in Israel and festival, only practice in the diaspora. And in 1970, Shlomo Goren revived it as a mass public ceremony at the Western Wall, creating the twice-yearly spectacle that draws over 100,000 people today.
Underneath all of that, the same 15 words. The oldest biblical text we have physical evidence for, still being recited by descendants of the same priestly family in the same city 2,500 years later. Whatever else you want to say about it, that's remarkable. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Bhutanese blind cave fish, discovered in 1927 in a subterranean stream in Bhutan's Paro Valley, is the world's smallest cave-adapted vertebrate, measuring just over 2 centimeters in length. It has no eyes, no pigment, and navigates entirely through a pressure-sensing lateral line system that detects water displacement from prey smaller than a grain of rice.
A fish smaller than your thumbnail? Blind. Living in total darkness in Bhutan. That's a whole philosophy in one fact.
That one's going to sit with me.
Next time on My Weird Prompts, we'll look at another ritual that survived the temple's destruction. But this one involves a goat, a cliff, and the word scapegoat that you've been using wrong your entire life.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in. We'll chase the thread.
My weird prompts, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host.
My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.